So just to give you a little more detail on our guest today, Dr. Tina Moore has nearly 3 decades of experience in the medical field. She's a leading holistic expert in regenerative medicine and resilient metabolic health. She fixed people who are metabolically busted. She's trained in alternative science and medicine as a naturopathic doctor and chiropractor. And she's a podcast host, a speaker, a kettlebell devotee, a mother, an advocate for health autonomy. She's got a great podcast called The Dr. Tina Show. She's passionate about making people actually better. And Callie Means, who has been on the podcast before, is the founder of TrueMed, a company that enables tax-free spending on food and exercise. He's also the co-author with his sister, Dr. Casey Means, of Good Energy, The Surprising Connection Between Metabolism and Limitless Health, which is available right now. Earlier in his career, Callie was a consultant for food and pharma companies and is now exposing those practices that they use to weaponize our institutions of trust. In the past year, he's met with 50 members of Congress and presidential candidates advocating policies to combat the corruption of pharma and food industries. He's a graduate of Stanford and Harvard Business School. And this podcast is going to be a doozy. It's a bit long, but I encourage you to stay with us the whole time. We get into all of it, from the macro, what is causing our obesity epidemic, our metabolic crisis, and what we can do about it from the social and political level, but also on the micro. What about that person sitting in our office or struggling with weight and struggling with being obese and not knowing how to get out of that pickle? And what is the right way to do it? What are the pros and cons of these new drugs, GLP-1 agonists? Are their side effects real? Do they have benefits beyond weight loss? Should we be using them? How should we be using them? Are the regular pharmacological approaches wrong? Is there another way using microdosing or compounded pharmaceutical versions of these peptides that might be actually safer and better used with a 360 approach for lifestyle? So we're going to get all of these, and you're going to be in a very robust, sometimes heated discussion about Ozempic and the GLP-1 agonist. So stay with us for the whole thing, and I know you'll love it. Let's dive in right now. All right. Welcome, Tina, and welcome, Callie. It's great to have you both on the show.
Pumped to be here.
Thank you.
Okay. So this is such a rich topic, and it's so deep. And I spent probably 15 hours preparing for this podcast, my reading, everything that both of you written, reading study after study after study, looking at the data very carefully. And I can honestly say that after not just reading the headlines, but between the lines, reading the research, I've come to understand that this is a very nuanced conversation. It's not just good or bad. It's not just we should do it or we shouldn't do it. It's really about understanding, one, the bigger social context in which this is happening. The bigger social context is we are facing a metabolic health and obesity crisis that's never been seen before in the history of humanity. There's over 1 billion people who are obese, 2 billion people who are overweight in the world. We have in America, it's even worse. We have 42% obese. We have 75% overweight. And 93.2% metabolic and healthy, meaning they're on the spectrum of some poor metabolic dysfunction, which is making them on their way towards pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes. And the costs are staggering. We know our healthcare costs are now $4.3 trillion in direct costs. And probably 80% of that is for chronic disease, mostly caused by our food and primarily driven by this phenomenon of insulin resistance, which is part of what Ozempic and these drugs purport to fix. So as we start to think about how do we solve this problem, you know, I've been thinking about it from the very macro view, which is how do we deal with the food environment, the toxic food environment that's caused us to be in this situation? This is not a genetic problem. There may be genetics that load the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger. And the environment has changed in the last 50 years so dramatically that it's led to an abundance of toxic food, ultra-processed food, high starch and sugar in our diet, ingredients we've never had before that are destroying our microbiome, that are destroying our nutritional resilience, that are causing poor metabolic health, and are really at the root of so much of what's going on. So I focused on policy issues. I wrote my book, Food Fix, which is an attempt to kind of lay out why this is happening. Because I realized I couldn't cure diabetes in my office. It's cured on the farm. It's cured in the factory where they make the food. It's cured by, you know, in the grocery store, in the kitchen. That's where diabetes is cured. And ultimately, I realized I had to go upstream to deal with the root causes, which is our bigger food system. And we're going to get to talk about that with Callie, because he's been talking about it and thinking about it for a long time. And I think his new book, Good Energy, addresses a lot of these issues around metabolic health. It's his sister, Casey Means, who's been on the show. Now, I often get them confused. Callie, Casey, is, I don't know what their parents were thinking. I think I've sorted it out, you know? And Tina has a very different perspective, which is really around the micro, not the macro, which is how do we deal with individuals struggling with metabolic dysfunction who've tried everything, done everything, hit the wall, can't make it work, struggle, white knuckle, and just can't get their bodies back into a state of good metabolic health. And we're going to talk about how she does that, why it's different than the traditional approaches to the use of these drugs, and why we need to rethink how we're doing this. So this is going to be a very interesting conversation. I'm really excited to dive in. And so first, we're going to start with the macro and start with Callie, because I want you to set the stage for the situation we're in around our poor metabolic health and obesity, and what this is doing to us as a society, economically, socially, politically, even in terms of our social divisions and conflict, all driven by the effect of these things on our physical and mental health. So can you kind of unpack for us, Callie, how you see the current state of affairs in the realm of weight and obesity? Now, I really just read an article this morning that said it's not okay to say someone's obese. You have to say they're someone with obesity. I get it, but we kind of have to sort of take a hard look at this. And so tell us from your perspective, how should we be thinking about this problem at a macro level?
Thank you so much for convening this conversation. Dr. Teen has had a huge impact on me, and I really think this is important to have a long-form, nuanced conversation that goes over the micro and the macro. And as you said, I've been really focused on the macro. I think there's some really important macro considerations that patients need to know before thinking about Ozempic, and that is that this is really about the median American and the median American child. 94% of the country is metabolically dysfunctional. Something has happened all at once, as you point out so well in Food Fix. Just looking at kids, 20 to 25% of young adults having fatty liver disease, 50% of young adults being overweight or obese. By some counts, 33% of young adults having prediabetes. It's a moral stain on our country where I think through very observable and very definable situations, we're poisoning our kids. We're poisoning them chiefly by food, the rise of ultra-processed food, which was close to 0% 100 years ago, and now up to 70% of a child's diet by some counts.
It all started with Crisco in 1911?
Yeah, and it started with good intentions after World War II to kind of feed the world and make ultra-processed food, but it's been weaponized. And, you know, food companies now are one of the largest employers of scientists to weaponize our food against us. And I can't go to a playground with my two-year-old without seeing almost every kid there, you know, drinking Coke, drinking sugary drinks. So fundamentally, this is a question about what is the solve for this metabolic health crisis and the different branches on that crisis of the diabetes crisis, the heart disease crisis, the obesity crisis. And I think my main point is that the medicalization siloing of chronic disease has been an utter failure.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying a doctor shouldn't prescribe a statin or metformin if that's the case and that's the determination, but the overall default to isolating and medicalizing a chronic condition has been bad. The world would be a better place if we actually didn't go this route of seeing heart disease as a statin deficiency, seeing diabetes as a metformin deficiency, seeing high blood pressure as an ACE inhibitor deficiency, seeing depression as an SSRI deficiency. My argument, I actually think the data is clear on this. If those drugs were—
You mean depression is not a Prozac deficiency?
Yeah, exactly. And my argument, I think the data is clear on this. If you actually took those drugs off the table, if they didn't exist, and the medical system actually asked, what's the root cause of these conditions? What should we spend $4.5 trillion on actually solving these conditions? It would actually go to the things you talk about core lifestyle habits. And the issue and what the obesity epidemic represents, with 80% of American adults now being overweight or obese, is that we really have a dirty tank. We have a fundamentally lost our way in crony capitalism and rigging the system, basically poisoning the American people. And is that an Ozempic deficiency? Should we do more of the same in the most pronounced chronic condition for the median American, for the median child? Mm-hmm. Should we be prescribing the Ozempic? And I really think when you reel that back, the answer is no, right? I'm not talking about, you know, 400-pound, extremely diabetic person. That's between the patient and the doctor. But when the American Academy of Pediatrics is saying that the average 12-year-old should be on Ozempic, when this is being pushed on 6-year-olds who have an obesity crisis, that gets over 20% of kids in the U.S. have childhood obesity. In Japan, it's 3 to 4%, right? We have unique dynamics happening in America, and it completely takes our eye off the ball to say that's an Ozempic deficiency. Novo Nordisk right now is the 12th most valuable company in the world. It's the most valuable company in Europe.
It's the biggest contributor to GDP in Denmark, the country
right.
that...
but interestingly, their revenue and profits aren't coming from Europe.
Is it true they don't allow Ozempic to be sold in Denmark? Is that true?
It's not the standard of care. First off, in Denmark, it's under $100 and they are making all their money off Americans, where they charge $1,600 to $1,800.
A month.
they're taking advantage of Americans. But it's not the standard of care in Denmark. I was in Denmark last year. They have sound food policies. Their people are biking, walking around. And actually, if you have obesity, the doctors are able to prescribe exercise and a keto diet that's subsidized by the government. Ozempic is not the standard of care for obesity. When you actually look at the stock analysis, 80 to 90% of profit expectations are coming from the United States. Yeah, they're taking advantage of the United States. So we have a dirty fish tank, right? The problem is not an Ozempic deficiency. The problem is, when are we going to say we're going to stop poisoning kids?
They're talking about using this in kids, but we're filling the schools with ultra processed junk food that these kids are eating for lunch, and that the school lunch program is so messed up that these kids aren't getting healthy, nutritious food that's helping them be metabolically healthy or mentally healthy.
Right. So then we look at, okay, how would I use this for? The instructions on Ozempic is as a lifetime drug. It actually, there was a warning. So let's just look at what Novo Nordisk says. They said this is not a quick use. This is not for a kickstart. This is a lifetime drug, and there's actually some serious warnings if you go off the drug and gain the weight back, and actually unknown metabolic effects. So that's what Novo Nordisk says. And they're actually saying, with the help of the American Academy of Pediatrics, which early in my career I helped pay, by pharma companies, this is a subsidiary of pharma companies. This Danish company is one of the top contributors to it. They're saying that a 12-year-old, it should be the first line of defense. It shouldn't be after dietary interventions fail. It says if a 12-year-old gains a little bit of weight, put them on this drug for life.
So the American Academy of Pediatrics doesn't have first-line therapy as lifestyle?
They're saying that we need urgent, quick interventions on surgery and Ozempic, and not after dietary interventions fail. That's what the recent press release and guidance from the American Academy of Pediatrics
said. Well, that seems pretty messed up.
The American Academy of Pediatrics has not spoken out about Coca-Cola machines in pediatric wards and classrooms. They've not spoken out about the fact that 10% of food stamp funding goes to Coca-Cola. They've not spoken out about our agriculture subsidies, but they have said that if your 12-year-old gains a little bit of weight, they need to be on this injection for the rest of their life. Now, what's the problem with this, right? As we know from your work, that if you're not taking the opportunity to train that child on metabolically healthy items, to train them on exercise, to train them on healthy food, to train them on having awe and curiosity for what they're putting in their body, they're going to continue to rack up comorbidities. You know, if somebody's anorexic, their LDL levels are probably going to go down right away, but that's not a sustainable long-term strategy. That's essentially what Ozempic does. It's a crash course calorie deficit. Not train that child, you know, for any type of awe or curiosity or lifestyle change that's needed, even if they're eating and on this drug for life, right? They're fundamentally still sedentary, like our kids are, and still putting ultra processed food, which is going to lead to other metabolically healthy items. So what doctors are saying now is that, and I think you've said this, that you have to exercise. You have to, and actually Novo Nordisk is even admitting this. They're saying you have to shift to
from their studies that you lose significant muscle mass.
They're saying that it's a huge disaster if you take this drug and don't exercise 4 to 5 times a week with weight training and shift to a non-ultra processed food, high protein diet. My message is this.
Yeah.
Let's start with that first. Let's start with steering the trillions of dollars of incentives of our medical system to doing that first before we're drugging into it. Because it's a contradiction, because what's actually happening is you have doctors at Harvard and the American Academy of Pediatrics saying the reverse. They're saying that obesity is now genetic. They have to define obesity as genetic in order to get taxpayer funding for this drug. You actually have the leading obesity researcher at Harvard, Dr. Fadima Cody Stanford, saying throw willpower, throw diet, throw exercise out the window. So on the one hand, you actually have doctors arguing that this is a genetic condition and basically a drug deficiency.
Isn't she conflicted a little bit?
And she's paid, so we can get into the corruption. When we have a dirty tank, when you have this massive societal issue, the biggest branch of the tree of metabolic dysfunction, when are we going to say that our healthcare policy needs to go towards metabolically healthy habits? In this case, Ozempic is a problem for two ways. Number one, it's a distraction. It's once again saying the cure is in the medication. We're telling 50% of 12-year-olds who are overweight or obese, you're okay. The doctors aren't saying that the kid has to work out 4 times a week and shift their diet. That's not what anyone is saying
no
to that.
Phys ed in schools
you're
anymore,
saying
right?
You're saved now from this drug. That's why I think this problem is one of the biggest issues in the country. Ozempic is a disaster if the drug was perfect, because it's giving the wrong message when it's not the solve to the problem. And there's a massive opportunity cost where for $1,500 to $1,800 a month, we could change our agriculture system to regenerative ag. We could give every obese child in the country a card to buy organic whole food. So it's a disaster from that perspective. It's also medically extremely problematic. This actually, to my estimation, you tell me, I think it's actually the highest and most pronounced side effects of any drug widely approved in modern American history. 80% of people on this drug have nausea and 30% have extreme vomiting. It has a black box warning, which we should take seriously. If we take the other studies seriously, we should take that very seriously, a black box warning for thyroid cancer. And the issues are so pronounced for mental health because it's disrupting our microbiome, which produces 95% of our serotonin. The EU, which is actually much more quizzical about this drug, is launching a massive investigation for suicidal ideation.
I looked at that data, and I think there's some questions about it.
Well, this is short-term data. Yeah. This is exactly the point, actually. This is extremely short-term indicators. They approved this drug on a 68-week rig study to approve for 12-year-olds for life. The research, if it's showing any leading indicators that Novo Nordisk has to admit, that's a serious problem, because these are all their studies are funded by Novo Nordisk and very rushed. So if there's any indicator whatsoever, which necessitates that black box warning. The other thing I'll say is, let's just back up and go to like what I've learned from you, which is that what is our body telling us? If 80% of the people have nausea, if 30% are throwing up, that's telling us that this drug is producing some unknown metabolic issues throughout our body and really has some interconnected problems that we fully don't even understand. That's what it tells me.
I think it's true. There are a lot of side effects if you take it in a way that actually is prescribed currently, but there are other ways of using the drug. We're going to talk about with Tina that mitigate a lot of the side effects, that avoid a lot of the problems you're talking about, and that aren't using the product that's from the pharmaceutical industry. Is from compounding pharmacies, which is a kind of a left field thing that people don't know about. But what's really striking is you can get these drugs for $20 a month if you get them from compounding pharmacies and at doses that are far lower that may be effective without a lot of the complications and side effects, and combined with a lifestyle. You know, it made me think about the MAPS work, which is psychedelic research, and probably this year MDMA therapy with psychotherapy is going to be proved. So it's bundled. You can't get MDMA without also having psychotherapy. You shouldn't be able to get Ozempic or any peptide like that that's driving this problem without actually having a bundled service of an aggressive lifestyle change, including dietary and exercise training and services.
Well, I think the MAPS and what's happening with MDMA approval is one of the most important events in the country and probably for another podcast. I just say, and I'm excited about this nuanced conversation, but working for the pharma companies, I do think this nod to exercise and healthy eating, it is a joke. Like the pharma companies are laughing about that, right? They know, right? Fundamentally, we're incentivizing the American people with trillions of dollars to eat poison and then be drugged. The largest industry in the country, every lever of it makes money on interventions on people that are sick, and there's a high incentive for people to stay sick. And that's been the history of the post-World War II chronic disease complex. So what we have to do is clean the tank.
What do you mean by clean the tank?
We have an ability today to take the $4.5 trillion that we spend on healthcare, and when somebody comes in with obesity or when a child comes in with obesity, for the standard of care to be actually incentivizing and medically recommending diet and exercise, as we're already admitting that has to be done on Ozempic already. My point is this: every patient should know this. Ozempic, everyone agrees that this drug is highly problematic unless you do 4 to 5 days a week of intense strength training and shift your diet to non-ultra processed food, high protein. Do that first. And by cleaning the tank, and this is what TrueMed's doing, this is what we're lobbying for, we can steer medical dollars. It's the incentives that are damaging us in this country.
Totally.
Again, in Japan, look at the obesity rates, look at the childhood obesity rates, look at the diabetes rates. This is a unique problem based on the incentives of America that we can fix, but it's not shoving an injection into 50% of U.S. children.
Let's look at this from a different perspective, because I think all the things you're saying are accurate. And I think we need to look at this from the perspective of the paradox between an incredibly toxic food environment. Because you're saying eat better, exercise, but if 67% of kids' diets is ultra-processed food, some estimates by some studies show it's 73%. And we live in a toxic nutritional landscape where it's almost impossible to do the right thing. We live in a society that fosters a sedentary lifestyle, that has no incentives in school for healthy eating or for movement for kids. We have to change the structural phenomena that are driving this. Paul Farmer talked about structural violence. What are the social, political, and economic conditions that drive disease? That has to be dealt with. But at the same, and that's what we're doing. That's what you're doing in Washington. That's what I'm doing in Washington with the Food Fix campaign, is trying to change the policies that are driving this, from marketing of junk food to kids, to subsidizing the commodity crop that are turning into junk food, to food stamps that are paying for junk food. I mean, the list goes on and on. For paying for nutrition services and in medicine, for changing Medicare reimbursement, changing all the things that we know need to be changed to actually drive a bigger societal systemic change. But there is a paradox here, because we are already metabolically, as you say, busted, Tina. And when you have someone who's metabolically screwed up from being in this toxic soup of processed food and junk food and sugar and starch that has caused them to become metabolically obese and metabolically busted, it's really hard to kind of get people out of that. It's like they're stuck. One of my professors, Sidney Baker, who's one of the, I think, most brilliant scientific minds in medicine in the 20th century and 21st century, said, you know, sometimes you need 100 horses to get people who are really stuck unstuck. So when you have these really chronically ill patients with multiple dysfunctions metabolically, inflammatory issues, gut issues, immune issues, it takes a lot of effort to pull them out of the mud. And sometimes you need a whole team of 100 horses. And so the question is, how do we both deal with the things you're talking about, which is the corruption of pharma and the corruption of medicine? And this has happened, by the way, and you talk a lot about this, Callie Howe. $27 million spent by Ozempic company manufacturer Novo Nordisk to fund doctors and others who are promoting this drug. So there's a lot of corruption in the system. They're funding the NAACP, so they come out in favor of Ozempic, and they say it's systemic
registered
racism,
lobbyist, yeah,
if you don't prescribe it. But at the same time, we have to deal with all the corruption from the pharma industry and from internally in medicine, how things are done. We have to also accept that we're in this incredible crisis where people are struggling and they can't get better, even if they want to and they try.
I would just say we have to solve that. We have to assess that crisis. It's the biggest issue we face. The fact that we're getting sicker, more depressed, more infertile at an increasing rate is the biggest issue in
it
the
is,
country.
100%.
And nobody would look at that issue and say that that we should keep letting that happen and then jab 50% of 12-year-olds with the drug.
Right.
There's no evidence that this helps kickstart. This is a lifetime drug, but as many doctors have noted, the second you go off a crash course diet, this is an injectable kind of calorie deficit crash course diet. The data is very clear. The second you go off this drug, you gain the weight back. You have to get to the root cause. You have to get people exercising and food. There's nothing without that.
True, that can work. But for some people, it still doesn't. And as a doctor seeing patients, you know, with all the best intentions, people struggle, even if they know what to do, even if they're educated, even if they're doing it. I've seen people struggle. And so the question is there a way to think about this class of drugs differently? Is there a way to think about it not from the pharma point of view, which is lifelong drugs, which is high doses, which is pharmaceutical injections that cost $1,700 a month that nobody can afford, that's going to bankrupt society? Is there another way to actually think about using these drugs to help people who really struggle? And what are the pros and cons? And what is the science behind it? And how does this work? And I think this, I would love sort of, Tina, to you start by talking, and we're going to get into all the details, because I see you like in your chair waiting to get going. And I'm gonna get you let go and come in a minute. Because I think Callie laid out beautifully how we're in a really screwed up political system, a corporate corruption system with pharma, of how they operate and how they fund things like the promotion of these drugs at wide scale through co-opting professional societies like the American Academy of Pediatrics, by funding, you know, Harvard and other institutions to do the studies, which they get huge amounts of money from. I mean, there's so much corruption in the system. But there is another way to think about helping people who really struggle with their weight and with the metabolic consequences. For many of my patients, caffeine can disrupt sleep, spike anxiety, lead to hormone imbalances. It's also incredibly hard on the gut, causing irritation that many don't even realize is happening. And that's why I'm so excited to share with you a truly remarkable alternative, Peaks Nenduka. Nenduka is the first-in-class coffee alternative that offers all the comfort of a warm morning drink, but without the downsides of coffee. It's crafted from fermented pu'er tea, which provides a clean, sustained energy boost and a powerful blend of adaptogenic mushrooms that enhance stress resilience and support hormone health. The ceremonial-grade cacao not only gives Nanduka a delicious chocolatey flavor, but also activates your metabolism, helping you avoid the crashes that come with coffee. I've made the switch myself, and the benefits are clear. Calm, sustained energy, better focus, and no gut irritation. If you've been thinking about giving up coffee, now's the perfect time to try Nanduka. Peak is offering up to 20% off plus a complimentary beaker and rechargeable frother. Just visit peaklife.com/hymen20. That's peakuelife.com/hymen20. If you heard me talk recently, you probably know how much I love Himalayan tardy buckwheat, a gluten-free seed loaded with longevity-promoting nutrients. My good friends at Big Bold Health have been carefully growing and researching this ancient plant for years. After tons of positive feedback from me and thousands of customers, they produced the world's first 100% organic Himalayan tartary buckwheat sprouted powder that's easier to digest, richer in vitamins and minerals, and contains up to 10 times more plant nutrients like rutin and quercetin. I love this as a topper in my yogurt, a sprinkle on savory meals, or as an easy add to my smoothies and protein shakes. The sprout powder has no fillers, additives, or sugars, and is farm sprouted and packaged in the USA. Right now, Big Bold Health is offering my listeners a special offer of 30% off this amazing product. You can try it now by heading to bigboldhealth.com and use the code DrMark30. Again, that's bigboldhealth.com.
And as you know, as I was sort of reading your stuff, Tina, and thinking about what your perspective is, and we talked briefly yesterday on the phone, it really brought up the question of why are so many people having trouble, and is there something that is regulating the appetite that's so dysregulated? The GLP-1, and we're going to talk about what is GLP-1, what does it do in the body, how does it work, because I think this is important for me to understand. We're going to get a little sciencey here, but if you understand that maybe like we have a crisis of hyperinsulinemia, we also may have a crisis of low GLP-1, which is a peptide in the body naturally occurring that helps to regulate appetite. Why are people unable to control their appetite? Why are people so stuck in knowing what to do and not being able to do it? Is there merit here to this concept that maybe because of factors that we're going to talk about that have come recently in the last 50, 60 years that have influenced our biology, that have made us low in GLP-1, that's driving us to overeat and overconsume and accelerate this obesity crisis? So Tina, why don't you start by helping us, and we're going to let you kind of wind up and hit a home run here. But why don't you start by telling us, like, what is GLP-1? What does it do? Why is it important in the body? And how does it work? Because I don't think most people understand what this is about. And then we